Good evening, everyone, and welcome. If I haven't yet met you, my name is Kathy, and I'm happy you could all come out tonight on this beautiful, almost fall evening. I was so happy and surprised to see tea in my water cup. Wow. It's like fruity. It's good. Well, I was inspired by Kokyo sharing of a traditional Zen story last week, and it ended up with some Bob Dylan. Now, I'll start with a traditional Zen story, and I won't end with Bob Dylan, but I did bring some poetry. Because I think often poetry, and I consider Bob Dylan's lyrics to be poetry, sometimes that's the best way to express things, and Zen has a very strong tradition of poetry. So I want to start by sharing the story, and this is a story about a woman who was Japanese in the 13th century. Her secular name was Chiyono. And this is quite a famous story for those who read Zen stories. So in this story, she's described as a servant of humble birth who was practicing in a Zen convent. And one day she approached an elderly nun and she said, "I'm of humble birth. I can't read or write and must work all the time. Is there any possibility that I could attain the way of Buddha?" And the nun answered her, "Of course, my dear. In Buddhism, there are no distinctions between people. There is only this, that each person must hold fast to the desire to awaken and to cultivate a heart of great compassion. People are complete as they are." And then she goes on to offer a little bit more instruction. So Chiyono was quite happy to hear that. And it's like, great, then all I have to do is just go about my daily work and practice diligently with the desire to awaken and cultivating a heart of compassion. So she practiced for a while longer, but she was still a little bit frustrated that this awakening thing didn't seem to be happening. And then one night she went out under the full moon to get some water from the well, and she was carrying this old bucket, and the bottom of the bucket just fell out. The bucket broke. You know, the strands just couldn't hold it together anymore. So the bamboo strips gave way. The reflection of the moon vanished with the water. And when she saw that, she experienced great awakening. And as is the habit of many folks in Zen, a poem is written on such an occasion. So the poem she wrote, and this is something that is kind of out in the Zen literature, in various forms, but this version, she says, "With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. Where water does not collect, the moon does not dwell." So when we work with these stories, there's lots of different dimensions and angles that we can do. And I want to actually turn this teaching of this story through at least three, maybe four different ways of looking at how we here in the 21st century can receive this teaching and how it can support our lives and our practice. So the first dimension that we can consider is kind of just the face value of what's happening in the story and literally what the elder nun told her, which in and of itself is a pretty incredible thing to contemplate. How many of you, whether you're new to practice or you've been practicing a long time, have ever had the thought of, I can't really do this because, and then what? My mind is too busy, I'm too young, I'm too old, I'm too distracted, I have kids, I have to work, I'm too stubborn, whatever. I mean, a lot of us, we always feel like we're kind of falling short, and therefore we can't practice the Dharma. We can't attain the way of Buddha. And so here is this elder nun who's been practicing for longer, saying, actually, all that matters, it doesn't matter who you are, what you are, what matters is that you have the desire to awaken. You have the desire to awaken and you cultivate a compassionate heart. It's not about what accomplishments you have, what degrees you have, how much you know, how clever you are, or any of that. It's about the quality of your intention and the diligence of your practice. Now, this teaching, so there's that. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. So that's one of the real potent takeaways that we can have right away from this story. But then another thing that we could look at is the symbolism, the teaching of her awakening experience, and particularly as expressed in her enlightenment poem. Here she is saying, "With this and that, I tried to keep the bucket together." Are you trying to keep your bucket together? How do we keep our bucket together? Our identity, our story, who we think we are. Oh, I'm a, you know, again, fill in the blanks. Or trying to appear perfect, not showing our rough sides, our vulnerable sides. You know, this is part of why we suffer so much. We think, oh, everybody else has it so together, and I don't. Well, guess what? They don't either, but they're not showing you that. I've had people tell me before when I have mentioned now and then, oh, yeah, I get depressed. And they say, you? You get depressed? But you're always so happy and upbeat. And I say, yeah, because when I'm depressed, you don't see me. I stay home. I'm not proud of that, but I hide. So when I come out, it's generally when I'm feeling better. That's why you don't think, but of course, you know, we don't show each other generally those parts. We're trying to look like, yeah, I've got it together. I'm it's working for me, right? So here she is with this and that, right? We all have this and that, whatever. Whatever are the ways we try to hold it together. I tried to keep the bucket together, and then the bottom fell out. No matter how hard we try, you know, sometimes life makes the bottom fall out. You know, you have a great loss, or something happens that you just can't keep it together anymore. You lose it. Or things are taken from you, and all of a sudden your identity in the community or your profession or your relationship, and, you know, all of a sudden you're not that anymore. The bottom falls out. Zen practice actually tries to help the bottom fall out. If you work in the traditional way with a Zen teacher, they're constantly trying to pull the bottom out from your bucket, because the idea here is we want to release the grip of our identities and our attachments and our ideas and what we think about everything, and have a little bit of spaciousness and a little bit of not knowing and liberation. So classic Zen training is about helping the bucket fall apart. This was one of the things last week that touched me when, near the end of the talk, Kokyo just, and I think it was in the Dylan song about being broken, right? It was the song, it was about being broken. You know, often in this, you know, general culture here, you would think, oh, broken, being broken, that's bad. It's something you want to hide from people if you feel broken. And yet in that song last week that Dylan was singing, I mean, he was just naming over and over all these ways that we're broken. You know, Leonard Cohen famously said, you know, the crack. There is a crack in everything. That's where the light gets in. So again, he was a sort of a Zen guy. So this poem is speaking to that different way of looking at what could be considered misfortune or difficulty or brokenness, that actually it's a liberation. And indeed, Chiyono experienced that as a liberation when the bottom finally fell out. Ah. There's another Zen poem, my barn having burned to the ground, I can finally see the moon. So that's one aspect of how we can think about the teaching of this story. And yet, of course, one of the things that we do in Buddhism and in Zen particularly is we always honor both sides. It's not just one side. So if we're listening to this going, oh, good, the way to be a good practitioner is to tear apart the bucket and not have a bucket. Well, guess what? Sometimes we need to hold things together. Maybe you could call that the form side. You know, the emptiness side would be, oh, good, the bucket broke. The form side could be, yeah, but sometimes you need a bucket to carry the water. So maybe you would want to fix the bucket so that you could carry the water. There's that side, too. And in the book that I'm reading this case from, The Hidden Lamp, this is a book that was compiled not too long ago by Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. And it's stories from 25 centuries of women practitioners, and it has commentary by contemporary women Buddhist teachers about these cases. So, interestingly, the woman who is commenting on this case about Chiyono in this book points out, through her life story, kind of the other side, about the side where sometimes you do have to keep it together. She is a, at the time this book was published, she was the head teacher at the Lynn Croft Zen Sangha in New Jersey, and she was an heir in the Mizumi Bernie Glassman lineage, and she's a member of the Zen Peacemaker community. And she talked about her experience. She says, when I first heard Chiyono's verse, I had been practicing for 10 or 12 years, and I was keenly aware of the constant tension of keeping the bucket together. And for her, in her life history, this was particularly strong, because she was among the first generation of African Americans who went to integrated schools in the South. And she writes about how they had to keep it together. They had to be perfect. They had to not make a mistake. There was a vigilance that she felt every single day when she went into that white school and knew that all these people were scrutinizing her and were looking at her as the role model, you know. So she talks about the being hyper-vigilant to prevent any kind of problem happening. She also talks about the ability to tolerate this circumstance of being other constantly, to maintain a public identity in places where I was allowed but possibly not welcome. This was a very important skill for people of her generation, was to know how to keep that bucket together always. So in one way, that was a very valid and important survival strategy for her. But then she also says, I felt the exhaustion of years of vigilance, all aimed at protecting my idea of myself. So here is this beautiful example of both honoring, recognizing the need, the value of keeping the bucket together, and yet her deep relief in her own life when she came to practice and she realized, I can let go now. I can release some of this vigilance. I don't have to keep protecting this identity everywhere that I am. I forgot. There we go. That really helps. It's that time of year, my friends. So she says, moving between the patched bucket and the bottomless bucket, I can exercise my freedom to keep things together or let things come apart according to the circumstances. I have come to trust the true freedom of living where the moon does not dwell. So I love this idea of that when we have an understanding and flexibility in our practice, the freedom of that. So it's not like, oh, keeping it together, ego, I should not do that. It's more about, according to the circumstances, what is called for here? What is the best way for me, for one, to be showing up? Similarly, this is this case was also referenced by another practitioner who I'll talk about. And talking about that same case of Chiono, she says, when the conditions that have defined the boundaries of self dissolve, we no longer need to guard against threats. We no longer need to grasp after rewards. Free of threats and objects of desire, we can drop worry and dissatisfaction and relax completely. And in that relaxed state, we realize our natural state, the enlightened state. We are no longer confined to the space within our skulls or to a water bucket. We are no longer, it's like as if this is the bucket, right? Our brain, these stories, our identity. We're no longer confined to the space within our skulls or to a water bucket when we can have this kind of freedom. So this is, you know, why Chiono experienced this as a liberation, as her great liberation. And this kind of both sides is one of the things I most love about Zen, truly. This ability to honor both the holding it together and the letting go. I brought these poetry books. These are haiku. They're called love haiku. The book is called love haiku, and maybe they're love haiku, some of them. But this one here speaks of honoring both presence and absence, which one could say is sort of the bucket and the no bucket, and the beauty of these. And I picked haiku that were written by people who were practitioners. So one of them, this was written by Chigetsu. And Chigetsu was practicing in the 17th century, maybe? Sorry. Oh, well. Here it is. Very short. One in flower, one not. Two poppies in a vase. One in flower, one not. Two poppies in a vase. Or this one, Presence and Absence, written by Mitsu Suzuki, who was the wife of Shunryu Suzuki, who's the teacher who brought our lineage from Japan. She wrote, when I eat a persimmon, I think of the one who loved them. So that's one way to consider this teaching, is kind of the face value of what the interactions of the people are and the teaching of the enlightenment experience. But there's two other dimensions that I'd like to point out. And one of them is the something I've been thinking about quite a lot lately with a lot of the activism that is really starting to arise more and more in, you know, we were a little wary a while ago in Zen to be active, socially, politically active, because it's like, oh, isn't that taking sides? Isn't that about attachment? You know, so there's been kind of some ferment there, but it, I think the balance is tipping, and those who are called to do that are just saying, I've got to do it. So I wanted to think about, in this story, the social and the cultural context in which this story is happening. Because when the elder nun, you know, when Chiyono is wondering, is it okay for me to practice? Well, first of all, it's kind of interesting. You shouldn't take these stories on face value. Because I did some historical research about this, and even though in this story she's represented as a servant who was of humble birth and said, I can't read or write, in other accounts, the woman, Chiyono, was described as she was the widow of a feudal lord who had been killed in battle, and she was very well educated. So that's kind of interesting when you think about her life. Okay, I mean, we don't know, but imagine that was true. She was well educated. She was the companion of a feudal lord. He was killed in battle, and now here she is, a servant in the convent, practicing. This is not uncommon when you read these stories that women in their 50s and 60s, you know, go to the convent. And maybe it was a little bit prescient when the elder nun said, oh no, in Buddhism, there's no distinctions between people. The only thing that matters is that you have the desire to awaken and cultivate a heart of great compassion. Well, at that time in Japan, it was, in fact, all over the world, it was incredibly difficult for women to practice the Dharma. I mean, Chiyono herself, this was another interesting thing when I poked around a little bit. She received Dharma transmission from a great Rinzai Zen teacher, Mugaku Sogen, and her Dharma name was Mugai Nyodai. She actually, they say in the book, despite resistance from the monks, she founded a temple, Keiaiji, which grew to include more than 15 sub-temples. She's actually acknowledged as the first female Rinzai lineage holder. So that kind of puts a slightly different flavor then on this elderly nun saying to this younger woman, of course you can do this. What matters is our desire to awaken great compassion. It doesn't matter what our distinctions are. So, you know, who knows how they're influencing each other to walk their different Dharma paths. It wasn't, and one could say, well, and there is a lot of this kind of, you know, women encouraging women, but there were also men who encouraged women practitioners at this very time, one of the greatest of which was our dear, beloved ancestor, Eihei Dogen. He wrote this amazing fascicle in the Shobogenzo called Receiving the Marrow by Bowing. And I think you can accurately call it a feminist rant. I don't want to read a lot of it to you. It's long. But first of all, he starts with Shakyamuni Buddha, quoting Buddha himself, you know, because he says, you know, some people say, that, you know, they discriminate about this person has good Dharma, this person has bad Dharma, this person is more enlightened than that person. And Dogen quotes Buddha as saying, in encountering teachers who expound unsurpassable enlightenment, do not consider their caste or facial appearance. Do not dislike their shortcomings or judge their activities. Just value their prajna, their wisdom. This is Buddha just, that's what matters. How does a person express and manifest their wisdom? And then he goes on to, you know, say, sprinkle celestial flowers for them, bow and pay respect, etc. And you'd think, oh, he's going to stay at this metaphorical level, but he goes on to be extremely specific about, you know, these people who think that women can't practice the Dharma, they're wrong, and he goes on and on and on. And I refer you to this if you want to read some pretty interesting early Zen feminist writing by A. Dogen. It's number 9 in the first volume of the Shobogenzo, Receiving the Marrow by Bowing. So this social and cultural context in which these stories happen, to me, is part of the Dharma here and part of what actually allows us to practice. In fact, another source of equality in Dharma practice is none other than the Lotus Sutra, which was one of the Mahayana sutras. And before that, there was a lot more distinctions and discriminations about who was more enlightened and who was less enlightened. But there's a line in nestled way in the middle of the Lotus Sutra, which says, all without doubt become Buddhas. This is Buddha talking. By the great vehicle, Buddha saves all creatures. All creatures rank equally, without difference, with me. When I was at Tassajara, the first time I went in 2001, Blanche Hartman was the abbess, and she was the lead teacher, and she was teaching the Lotus Sutra. And it takes a little getting used to. I mean, some of us really like that kind of ornate, flowery storytelling, and some of us are more simple, like, just get to the point. Well, the Lotus Sutra does not get to the point. It's like, and so some of the monks at the monastery were cranky about, why do we have to study this? This is like, we don't relate to this, and, you know. And Blanche kind of fumbled along. She said, I've never taught the Lotus Sutra, so I think it would be good for us to study this. And she tried this approach and tried that approach, and people were kind of cranky. And I remember one day in the Zendo from the Dharma Seed, she said, you know why we're studying the Lotus Sutra? It's because of the Lotus Sutra that I, as a woman, can sit in this seat. And I thought, dang, I don't need any other reason. that's good enough for me, right? So here is, you know, I'm not going to go on, but I just want to point out that it was not just, you know, the elder nun encouraging the young woman, but here's, you know, Buddha himself, and here's Dogen quoting Buddha, but also expounding his own experience, just honoring what we know now, of course, because we're so enlightened in the 21st century, that it doesn't matter your caste or your gender or, you know, your race or your social stature, that what matters is, as the elder nun said, your desire to awaken and your commitment towards cultivating a heart of compassion. Or as Buddha said, your prajna, your wisdom. So that's another dimension to consider. And yet another dimension is something that I love, which is the way that these stories offer us the ability to have a conversation across the centuries. And I would say, in fact, that Zen itself is one long conversation across the centuries. Because unlike religions where there is a book, a holy book, and everybody follows the book, and there's like a seminary where you go to learn the book, and then you're judged by how well you teach the doctrine of the book. You know, what book is that in Zen? I mean, we have tons of books, but there are all sorts of kinds of books and all different kinds of approaches. And there's all different kinds of approaches to Buddhism as well. So what makes Zen Zen? Well, it's called the teaching outside of the scriptures, which basically means it goes person to person. It doesn't go through credentialing doesn't go through the university. The way that a person becomes authorized in our tradition to teach is that someone who is already a teacher authorizes you privately through their experience of your practice and your prajna, your understanding of the Dharma. Someone says, yeah, we're one. And it's not even like, oh, here I am and I'm bestowing this on you. It's more like they recognize, yeah, we sing the same song. And please teach, you know. So it's person to person. We call it warm hand to warm hand. That's how the Zen tradition goes and continues. So I think there's also this way that we talk to each other through these stories. And there's many, many teachings that you can follow the strands. I've done this, for example, with something I've talked about from here, the language of the insentience. I'm not going to get into it, but it's basically a conversation over time that the ancestors, like one ancestor would have an insight, and then maybe 100 years later, another a student of Zen would quote that one and say, what did they mean? And then this teacher would say something, and then 300 years later, somebody would comment on that. And so it's a conversation through time. And indeed, here in this very book, we have an example of that. Because 100 years later, there's another nun practicing in a convent or a monastery, and her name is Nyozen, and she is studying the story of Chiyono, and her awakening is the bottom fell out of the bucket of that woman of humble birth. The pale moon of dawn is caught in the rain puddles. Is she saying the opposite thing? Wait a minute. Chiyono, the bottom fell out of the bucket of that woman of humble birth. The pale moon of dawn is caught in the rain puddles. So again, here we are playing with it, turning it. It's don't get a fixed idea. It's not, oh, the answer is that the moon was caught in the bucket and now the moon disappears and now we're enlightened. Yes, that's one experience. Here's another experience, which is, in the case of Nyozen, for Chiyono, it was no moon. For Nyozen, when the bottom falls out, the moon is everywhere. The moon is reflected everywhere. No moon, moon. You know, moon falls away, moon is everywhere. And this is just the continuance of this same teaching. And then, just to even, to make it even more fun, the 21st century teacher, Kuya Minogue, who comments on this case, this is how we do it. It's just this chain of commentary through time. She, and those of you who are interested in lineage, she was trained in the lineage of Jiyu Kennet Roshi. And she was lay ordained by Kyogen Carlson, who was an heir of Kennet Roshi. And at this time, she was the lead teacher up in a Zen center up in British Columbia. So she was having her at a women's retreat she had in 2011. They were studying these old Zen poems and writing their own poems. And her poem that she wrote about this experience of feeling this transmission through time of awakening, she writes, Nyozen's moon, ice crunches on the garden path. The pale moon of dawn opens the Zendo doors. Snowflakes melt in the heat. This pale moon that we're tracking through these poems and through these experiences opens the Zendo door. And it's so hot in there that the snowflakes are melting. Boy, time flies. And interestingly, the social and cultural context of Nyozen is she was practicing in a place that was established by nuns as a safe house. This is in the 13th century for women who were escaping domestic violence and marital abuse. They had a convent, and women could go there, and basically if they practiced for 3 years diligently as nuns, they were free to leave, and they gave them divorce papers when they left. So they were considered independent women once they left their 3 years of monastic training. And they did that for 600 years until divorce was legalized in Japan in 1873. So Nyozen, you know, this nun who's writing this poem, that's where she was practicing. And Kuya Minogue says that was her experience too. She came to practice to escape an abusive marriage. So again, it's not just the content of the Dharma, the moon, but it's also our lives and the ways that we support each other and the things that influence and that bring us to practice and the liberation that we find, not just intellectual or spiritual liberation, but social and cultural liberation as well through the Dharma, which kind of brings me to the present. I'm looking at the clock going, wow, time sure flies. Because, of course, now in the present, one of the, you know, there's many, many issues that we're struggling with and dealing with. And, of course, one of the big ones is just what's happening with our planet and the death of species and all that. And so we wonder, how do we practice with that? And this is one of the social and cultural contexts that our Dharma is, not exclusively, of course, there's lots of different ways that we're studying and practicing, but this is one of the things that we are trying to figure out how to practice with and teach about. So I think given the time, I want to close with a contemporary poem that speaks to this. You know, this dilemma that we have of what's going on in our world now. This is by a poet called Laura Weaver. The other poets were all Zen practitioners. She isn't, but I don't care because her poetry is awesome and dharmic to me. This poem is called Turning Towards. No matter how many times we shed, no matter how far and wide the spirit has soared, no matter how deeply the body knows the galloping hoofs of our own wild horse, there are days when we look in the mirror and see grief, shell shock, the fingers of time working our face like clay. There are days we forget our own name. The tears come as medicine, truth, nectar. Impermanence topples all of our dreams, even the beautiful ones. When the bottom falls out, when the foundation shifts, when the seismic quake rolls through, we know we are no thing that can be counted, that death lives with us in every breath, that the self is a blessed vessel cracked with starlight. And how is it that just as we release our grip, just as we surrender to this emptiness, just as we turn to what is most unbearable, a seabird flies in and begins to build a nest, one stick at a time, in the center of the heart. Soon, there are brilliant blue eggs. How is this so? You know, even as so much is dying on our planet, every second life is creating life. And both of these things are happening at the same time. Even as the self is a blessed vessel, a blessed cracked vessel, and we feel how death lives with us in every breath, and we know that we are no thing that can be counted. And just as we surrender to this, a seabird flies in and begins to build a nest, one stick at a time, in the center of the heart. And I think that's what keeps us going, is that we know that that is true, and we write about it, and we share this writing over time, and we read about the woman walking in the full moon night with the bucket, and we feel like, yeah, thank you for your practice. And we, of course, can do that for those that are yet to be. We can be that seabird, even as, you know, in this state of the world, life is wanting to create life. So we have a little bit of time if others would like to say something or ask something. Yeah, Helen. Yes.
It's something that leads to a spiritual path.
Yeah. Maybe that's what the elder nun was saying, you know, the desire to awaken, the ability to feel wonder and awe, possibility. Yeah. Thank you. Are you raising your hand or just... Yeah, yeah. I think that's what I love about poetry, is that we don't have to analyze it. We feel it. And they're not just eggs, they're blue eggs. Fragile blue eggs from which little birds will hopefully spring forth. Yeah, that's one side of it, huh? That's one thing that can happen. Yeah, no more moon. If you thought you knew what the moon was. No, you don't. And then 100 years later, the moon is everywhere. I love that. So sweet.
I saw myself a ring of bone and a clear stream of all of it. I vowed always to be open to it so that all of it might flow through. And then saw ring of bone, where ring is what a bell does. So that
Wow. Kind
of brought about the imagery of the vessel. And
yes.
The vessel having more than, yeah.
And shifting the different,
yeah.
The different ways to consider it and the different, that's beautiful. I didn't know that because, of course, you know, Gary Snyder named his Zendo Ring of Bone.
Oh, okay.
So he really honored that poem.
And Lou Welch committed suicide, so I think that's probably that whole relationship and story as well.
So there you go. Again, the social, cultural, psychological context of our practice. Mm-hmm. And now Ring of Bone Zendo is a thriving place in the foothills, and that name probably is very, very poignant for Gary. Yeah, thank you for bringing that forward. EQ. Lone is another moon poem, very Zen. Lone moon, no clouds, we stumble through the night. You know, there's a way. I mean, it's like, ow! This is the broken part of side. You know, this is the part of us that we don't know how to talk about, and that we're so, I don't know. You know, we live here and yet we're afraid of it. Not everybody, but a lot of us are. And so, you know, to be able to give words to this human experience that we have, you know, I read something like that, and even though, you know, on one level I'm like, oh God, that's so sad, I'm so joyful because I feel like that. So I'm like, oh, he felt like that, and I feel like that. I'm not alone. You know, I'm not the only person that's ever felt that. And I think that's often what these teachings of this aspect of life, that Zen does not turn away from this part. I'm alive, right? Don't we say that? We don't see the bones we walk on. He's one of my favorites. Anyhow, he's got lots of interesting poems in there. The Crow with No Mouth. Yeah.
The real kind is my favorite one. He comes back to his hut and it's been ransacked. In the middle of nowhere with nothing, he says, I would have given it away if you'd asked. And he wrote a little poem about it. He said, now the moon at the window, the thief must have forgotten it.
And then Joni Mitchell wrote a beautiful song. At least the moon at the window, the thief left that behind. Yeah. And it's about love, you know, but she, yeah. Oh, rather than singing that whole song to you, I will hold that back and we'll call it a night. We have a very special treat tonight. Corrine made fresh pit fruit raspberry crisp for tea. So after we each do our chants and after we have our announcements out in the still warm, almost dark evening, we can enjoy homemade early fall dessert. Thank you so much for doing that. Scott said he's never seen a person bring more books, so I was a little embarrassed about it, but it was all the poetry books. I can be embarrassed in front of you, right? Beings are numberless.